What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
Talks aimed at ending the war in Gaza have restarted. The White House wants Israel and Hamas to move quickly.
The fact that the sides are talking again, and this could lead to the end of the bloodshed in Gaza, that's a positive step.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll have more about the U.S.-backed ceasefire plan for Gaza and the well-known legend of Ernest Shackleton's doomed expedition to Antarctica in 1914. Turns out we're still learning new details about what happened.
As legends are, they don't require facts.
Also, young people in Russia talk about religious identity and wild elephants on the move, surprising people in one part of India.
But after a series of elephant attacks, the excitement has worn off. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us this Monday.
All eyes today are on Egypt's Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. That's where officials are gathered to discuss a possible end to the war in Gaza. Israeli and Hamas leaders are communicating indirectly. Egypt is a key mediator, along with Qatar and the United States. The World's Shirin Jafari is here with more. So what else do we know, Shirin, about who is at the talks today?
On the Hamas side, one person who is present is Khalil al-Hayya. He is a Hamas leader who survived an assassination attempt by Israel in Qatar just a few weeks ago. Israel struck the Hamas offices in Doha as these Hamas leaders were convening to discuss a ceasefire deal with Israel. And Khalil al-Hayya survived that attack, but his son was among the six people who were killed. But he is taking part in these negotiations today in Egypt. On the Israeli side, the delegation is going to be led by Ron Dermer, although some initial reports today suggested that he's not going to be there in Egypt himself, but that he will be joining later along with some of the other representatives. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is also taking part in these talks. Although Kushner doesn't hold any official position in the Trump administration, he has been involved in these negotiations for a while.
So that's kind of the who. What about details about what's been discussed so far?
Yeah, so U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation that there are two parts to these negotiations. One is to release the hostages, and the other is about the future of Gaza. He said right now the focus is on the logistics of getting the hostages out of Gaza.
Who's going to go pick them up? We saw how this happened in the past. You know, the Red Cross would go in. They would be handed over through this process, et cetera. And so all of that's what has to be worked on and is being worked on as we speak.
Rubio said that for the release of hostages to happen, the fighting must stop.
Yeah, and to that point, Shirin, it looks like the war has not stopped. The fighting continues.
It hasn't, and that's despite the fact that President Trump also told Israel that it must stop its strikes. We are still hearing about the attacks that kill Palestinians. Just today, I saw reports of a family being killed as they were trying to move to a safer place in Gaza. Over the weekend, the medical NGO Doctors Without Borders said that one of its staff was killed while waiting for a bus to take him to a field hospital where he works. And it said in the statement that this is the 15th member of its staff that is being killed in Gaza since October 2023.
Yeah, 15th MSF member. Yeah. These talks, Shirin, are based on the 20-point plan that Trump put forward late last week. What are some of the key points in there that could require skillful maneuvering?
The Trump administration is saying this is a roadmap and a framework for the end of this war in Gaza. President Trump presented it last week, and he has been pressing both sides, the Israelis and Hamas, to act on it and act fast. A lot of the details, though, remain unclear, like the exact posture of Israeli forces in Gaza after the hostages have been released. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke in a video over the weekend.
בפעימה אחת, כשצהל נשאר בעומק הרצועה ובשטחים השולטים בה.
He says, we are on a verge of a very great achievement. We are working on the details, but I hope in the coming days to announce the release of the hostages to you. The IDF remains in the depths of the strip and the areas controlling it. This is a key point, Marco, that Netanyahu is making in this video, is that it sounds like from what he's saying that Israel doesn't plan to withdraw its forces from Gaza, which is required in the plan that is being put forward by the Trump administration.
So what are Palestinians saying about the plan?
So Noura Erkat is a Palestinian-American scholar, and she was speaking on MSNBC over the weekend.
The terms and the stipulations are very vague. There are no timetables for when Israel is to withdraw. There are no borders to where they will withdraw.
But Marco, she pointed out that while these questions remain about the plan, the fact that the sides are talking again, and this could lead to the end of the bloodshed in Gaza, that's a positive step.
How does Hamas actually come up in this 20-point plan? Like, what role will they have to play?
They will have to give up power and disarm. Hamas has said that it doesn't want to govern Gaza after the war is over, but it hasn't said anything about putting down its arms. So the question right now is, can this issue be worked out in the negotiations in Egypt? And what happens if Hamas doesn't disarm? What are the next steps after that?
Big questions the day before the anniversary of the October 7th attacks. World Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
Let's turn to the war in Ukraine, where Russia's attacks have escalated since early yesterday. In the western city of Lviv, near the Polish border, 6 people were killed, including a 15-year-old. At least 18 others were injured. It was one of the most sustained attacks on the city since Russia's full-scale invasion, according to local military officials. A video from Ukraine's state emergency services captures the rapid-fire explosions over the city skyline at night during the drone and missile attack.
In a video address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the attack intentionally targeted civilian infrastructure.
Це енергетика, цивільні підприємства, склади, причому саме склади з цивільними товарами.
Zelensky also said there had been no worthy reaction from the West.
Нуль реальної реакції світу.
This is why Putin mocks the West, Zelensky added.
Overnight, Ukraine retaliated. Long-range Ukrainian drones and missiles hit a major Russian ammunition plant, a key oil terminal, and a weapons depot behind the front line. That's according to the Ukrainian military.
Russian authorities also acknowledged the attack that hit several Russian regions as well as Russian-occupied Crimea. The retaliatory strike was one of the biggest Ukraine has launched on Russia since the full-scale invasion began. The attacks come heading into the fourth winter of fighting in this war.
If you can picture the skyline in Moscow, you'll probably conjure up images of onion-domed churches. Christians do make up the majority of Russia's population, but the Russian Federation is also home to the largest Muslim population on the European continent. In some parts of the country, many different ethnic groups live alongside ethnic Russians, and Muslims in these regions tend to be proud of their identity even if they're not religiously observant. Levi Bridges has this look at how some young Muslims in Western Russia are juggling their multiple identities.
Russia's Muslim population is rapidly growing. In Moscow, there's even a shortage of mosques.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
In a video on YouTube, one mosque is so full that men pray in the street as a heavy snow falls. The Russian government promotes the Russian Orthodox Church as the country's true religion. Since Putin became Russia's president 25 years ago, ethnic minorities who practice Islam have repeatedly been arrested under anti-extremism laws. Russian authorities have also recently deported thousands of migrant workers from Muslim countries, harassing them with obscenities during the arrests, as captured in this video. But young Russians I talk to say they're not turning away from Islam because they're afraid. Their reasons are more personal. They didn't want to give their names or locations in Russia because identifying yourself publicly as having ties to Islam could potentially get you labeled as an extremist. One woman tells me she grew up studying the Quran with her babushka.
When I was a little girl, I felt like I was a Muslim. I really believed in Allah and I would ask him for things when life got hard.
She later studied theology at university. That's when she realized that her family practiced what she calls a folksy version of Islam. During the Soviet Union, religious practices were suppressed. Churches and mosques were destroyed. As a result, she says, Islam as an institution disappeared, and Islamic beliefs were passed down through generations as an oral tradition that changed over time. She says, take my cousin, for example. She fasts during Ramadan, doesn't eat pork, speaks Arabic, but she sometimes drinks alcohol. And my grandmother, she believes in superstitions and omens, which are forbidden in Islam. These contradictions eventually made her question organized religion entirely.
I believe in some kind of higher power, but I'm being agnostic now, so I'm not sure any church, including Islam, understands the right way to worship.
Other young Russians say religion just never felt right. I talked to one woman who says her family is an ethnic minority in Russia that traditionally practices Islam. She says her family doesn't believe women should attend higher education.
I always had to pretend that religion was important to me. And I did all the Islamic rituals, everything my family wanted. But only because I didn't want them to punish me.
When she became a teenager, her mother forced her to marry a guy she started dating. It wasn't what I wanted. I was basically held against my will, she says. She eventually broke up with the guy and doesn't really talk with her family anymore. She succeeded in going to university. That's where she met other secular Muslim women. They encountered some pushback, though. The way she and her friends acted bothered a deeply religious man in their cohort.
Sometimes we talked loudly about our romantic lives, or we'd read the instructions on packages of condoms out loud. And he'd get upset, but that didn't stop us. We were young and fearless.
But still, she says being an ethnic minority in Russia and a Muslim, it's part of her identity. I feel that part of my identity the strongest when I'm with Russians who have a similar background as me. And it's a great feeling, she says. But wrenching yourself away from your community can be confusing. Another young woman tells me she grew up in a Muslim family with conservative views on issues like abortion. In college, she became a feminist, but felt imposter syndrome. At first, I was ashamed to call myself a feminist, she says. The theology student I talked to says that informal groups actually exist all over Russia where women talk about their rights in Islamic teachings. She says even though Russia remains a deeply patriarchal country, there are exceptions.
Some Muslim women in Russian cities told me that they share the responsibilities of raising children equally with their husbands. The stereotype of a Muslim woman being a housewife doesn't match their reality.
Even as people are leaving religion and the Kremlin accuses Muslims of extremism, she says in her experience, some Muslims in Russia today are adopting a very moderate version of the faith. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges, Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
Coming up, the human impulse to explore remote cold places and the trouble that can ensue. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Over the weekend, more than 500 hikers found themselves trapped on a slope on Mount Everest. The hikers were at tourist campsites on the Tibet side of the mountain at an elevation of about 16,000 feet. That's when a storm dumped 3 feet of snow, crushing tents and blocking the hiking trail.
Rescuers used horses and oxen to clear paths through the snow and allow the hikers to descend. By Sunday afternoon, there were still 200 of them waiting to get off the mountain. That's according to Chinese state TV.
The tourist camp where the hikers were trapped is separate from the base camps used by climbers attempting to summit Mount Everest. At 29,000 feet, it is the highest peak in the world, and every year, several hundred people manage to reach the summit.
Our next story also takes us on an expedition that ended up in frozen limbo, but this one was more than a century ago. In 1914, explorer Ernest Shackleton led a group of men on a ship called the Endurance to the Antarctic Peninsula. You might be familiar with that famous story of survival.
The ship got stuck in the ice and eventually was crushed by ice and sunk beneath the Weddell Sea in Antarctica. But Shackleton managed to save his entire crew of 28 men. They spent months stranded on the ice before using lifeboats from the Endurance to set sail to Elephant Island in the southern Atlantic. From there, Shackleton and five men continued in one of the boats, reaching South Georgia Island and bringing back help. In total, the crew was out there for nearly 3 years. The wreck of the Endurance was only discovered in 2022, but now new details are emerging about what contributed to the disaster thanks to Yuka Tukuri.
Tukuri was on that expedition that found the Endurance. He used engineering analysis and the historical record to uncover a new reason that the Endurance was crushed by ice. When we spoke today, he described the accounts written by the crew members stuck in the ice back in 1914.
Like the sound, like a big train approaching somewhere, and squishing sounds when the ice was kind of under the ship. I mean, things were falling off from shelves, as an example, and walls were moving a little bit, bulging out, and the whole ship was vibrating in certain events violently, and the masts were shaking. I mean, this kind of structural responses for compressive loads.
Disquieting, to say the least, when that's your shelter in a very inhospitable environment. So the way this story has been told for many, many years is that this was the ice's fault. The ice crushed the ship. But you found some new details about the ship that give a little more nuance to that story. What did you find?
He found out that the ship was not as strong as the legend goes. As legends are, they don't require facts. And as the legend goes, Endurance was maybe the strongest polar ship ever built of its time, of course. But the whole ship was not strong enough to the task. Endurance was built in Norway, originally called Polaris. It was designed and built to take tourists to north, to the Arctic, to shoot polar bears. Mm. So the ship was designed to go to the outer edge of the ice pack, where what's happening there is that the ship is colliding with ice floes of large and small, but not that kind of situation where it's deep in the pack ice with compressive situation.
And can you describe why pack ice is different, so how it behaves when it encounters a ship?
We call pack ice the kind of the large area of sea ice that's like hundreds and hundreds of kilometers wide area. And then due to winds and currents, they create motion to these ice floes. And then suddenly, sometimes the ice floes go towards each other and create compressive situations. What then happens is that pressure ridges are formed, like small hills.
Right. So two pieces of ice can basically be slammed into each other by the currents or the wind and then form mountain ridges.
Yes.
In the ice. So you can picture the force with which they're colliding and what that would do to a wooden ship.
Exactly.
What was the ship lacking in design that would have helped it survive its ordeal?
So the outer shell of the ship was strong enough to collide with ice floes. But then when compression starts, it doesn't so much matter how sturdy the sides are, but what matters is what's between the two sides of the ship, deck beams. So there's decks there and deck beams. And those were not kind of as strong as in other ships of her time.
So the beams that stretch from side to side and front to back of the ship.
Yeah. And those were not, they were not strong enough, I would say, and there were not enough of them.
And you believe that Shackleton was aware that his ship was not strong enough to withstand pack ice, right? How did you discover that?
That was, in fact, really, really interesting. I was going very carefully through different sources that there are. And then when I started reading the book by German scientist Wilhelm Filchner, who had gone before Endurance the same Weddell Sea, and his ship was an old whaler. And Shackleton visited the shipyard and advised Filchner to strengthen his ship against compression. And then there's a drawing of those, they strengthening that Shackleton suggested. And then that was done, and Filchner went to the Weddell Sea, survived compressive ice, and everybody came back home. So Shackleton knew what it requires to kind of fight against compressive ice, because he recommended it to his colleague. And then the other thing is that he wrote to his wife in 1914, before sailing to the Weddell Sea, that this ship is not as strong as my earlier ship. And that's, it's, if not smoking gun, close to that.
Yeah. So he acknowledged in a letter to his wife that he knew his ship wasn't as strong as it could be.
Yeah.
Shackleton is widely seen as a hero. He's celebrated as a hero for delivering all of his men to safety in these terrifying conditions. Does what you have found change your understanding of his legacy?
Not really. Shackleton is still a polar hero, and he's still my polar hero. It is an achievement to kind of survive those conditions where they were, and especially the leadership that he showed to keep the group together and then get everybody home. And what I think is kind of very nicely said, he once wrote that he knew the souls of his men. And that's admirable. I mean, the selection of the ship, that's what a perfect decision in my mind. But also that decision I see in the way that Shackleton's style was to do things. I mean, I'm a careful person. So if I would do something like that, I would be very careful and long preparations, a lot of thinking. And then in the end, maybe I wouldn't go.
Mm.
But he had a different approach. He decided to go, and then he had funds and time, and then he went. And in my mind, he trusted himself that if something bad happens, he can handle the situation. Mm. And that's true. That's what happened then.
It ended up being true, although he couldn't have known that for sure. But I guess that's what you're saying.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think it was not bad luck that what happened, but they ran out of good luck. This is the way I think.
Jukka Tuukkuri teaches engineering at Aalto University in Finland. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news. shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. South Africa's system of apartheid ended more than 30 years ago. When it did, the struggle for democracy had already claimed at that point many victims, whose perpetrators never faced justice. Now the prominent case of Steve Biko is being reopened. From Johannesburg, Elna Schutz explains.
You may remember a movie from 1987 called Cry Freedom.
Bantu Stephen Biko.
Stephen Biko, black activist, a leader. He had the courage to speak out against oppression.
In it, Denzel Washington plays an important South African anti-apartheid activist.
Men, you can beat me or jail me or even kill me. But I am not going to be what you want me to be.
Biko's death, after weeks in jail, remains a seminal moment in the fight against apartheid.
A decade of challenging white supremacy left its martyrs. Among them, Steve Biko, charismatic leader of South Africa's Black Consciousness Movement. He died in police custody in September 1977.
Shortly after, an inquest into his death found nobody criminally responsible. 2 decades later, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, saw 5 police officers questioned about Biko's death. Their testimonies remained that the death was an accident.
Your Honor, we have said that during the scuffle, he bumped his head against the wall.
Which was wrongful. That was in self-defense because this man had gone berserk on your story.
It is altogether correct.
That is correct.
The TRC referred around 300 cases for further investigation, but few have ever gone to court. This year, on the anniversary of Biko's death in September, the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, Mamoloko Kubayi, reopened the inquest. Ministerial spokesperson Terence Manase.
The initial inquest found no criminal responsibility, a conclusion widely criticized at the time. Minister Kubayi said the decision to reopen the inquest reflects government's commitment to truth, accountability and justice and will allow the courts to re-examine the circumstances of Mr. Biko's death with fairness and transparency.
The minister describes the case as justice delayed, not denied, and Nkosi Nathi Biko, the activist's son and now CEO of the Steve Biko Foundation, echoes the sentiment.
One would even say that it is late, but nevertheless very welcome.
The family hopes the inquest will lead to a trial, despite some people involved having since died. While justice may not come in the form of direct punishment, Biko says finding out the truth during the inquest would hopefully lead to better public education and healing around the atrocities of the past.
The death of Steve Biko was occasioned by an assault, a massive assault on his person, which resulted in him dying from acute hemorrhage. And he was arrested a healthy man, and so it's not an accident that led to his death. He was in the company of policemen and emerged in the condition that led to his death.
This development comes after dozens of families took the government to court earlier this year to be held accountable for not pursuing investigations and prosecutions. The country's president responded about 4 months ago.
President Cyril Ramaphosa is set to establish a judicial commission of inquiry into the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, delayed cases that were referred to the National Prosecuting Authority.
In recent years, several inquests into the deaths of prominent anti-apartheid activists have been reopened, with some leading to convictions. Political analyst Sandile Swana says it is clear that there has long been political interference in these cases, and there is hope that they can now be considered more reasonably.
There is no question when looking at all the surrounding evidence of these cases, plus what was submitted to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission already, that the verdicts are more likely to find that there is culpability in the case of Biko on the part of the state.
He explains that the reopening of historical crimes is important because the current climate still sees such abuses of power.
The political killings are a problem in South Africa, even as we speak today. So the inquest into all political killings, especially the previous ones, is to eventually draw a line to say the idea and the practice of political killings in South Africa must come to an end.
The hope is that the Biko case will show that justice can be found, even if it is delayed. For The World, I'm Elna Schütz, Johannesburg.
Momentum around next year's FIFA World Cup in North America is starting to ramp up. Tickets are already on sale. Qualifying matches are in full swing. There's also growing noise to ban one team from competition, Israel. The World's Bianca Hillier has the latest.
The calls to ban Israel from international competitions have gotten louder as the war in Gaza has gone on for longer. But there's been a notable uptick since a few weeks ago when Navi Pillay, the chair of a UN commission, said this at a press conference.
The commission concluded that Israel has committed genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza and that it is continuing with that genocide.
Israel rejects the declaration, but the move has still galvanized people.
I think that when we talk about teams, national teams, of states that are subject to valid claims of genocide, yes, this is where this is for sure a red line.
Alexandra Zanthaki is part of a group of independent human rights experts at the UN. She says the label of genocide should mean Israel is suspended from international football or soccer in the U.S. Since then, more groups have echoed the demands for suspension. First, Turkey's National Football Federation, then Amnesty International, plus a coalition of nearly 50 professional athletes from a variety of sports. The group, called Athletes for Peace, released a video on social media likening the situation to another global conflict.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, UEFA acted within days. But today, despite mounting evidence of war crimes, Israel continues to compete. The rules have changed depending on who breaks them.
You would think that FIFA, the global governing body for soccer, would make the decision. But FIFA says it's up to UEFA, the sports governing body in Europe. It's unclear exactly why, but here's what FIFA Vice President Victor Montagliani said on Sky News.
I think it's important that we respect that it's UEFA's decision. Obviously, you know, UEFA and FIFA will be having whatever discussions they need to, no different than any other confederation would on any other member. It's an issue that changes from a geopolitics standpoint almost on a daily basis. There's a lot of moving parts with respect to that issue.
The Palestine Football Association, the PFA, has been asking for sanctions on the Israeli Football Association for years. Kat Volarev, a legal advisor for the PFA, says Israel has breached FIFA's human rights policies.
Maybe we have seen something similar in the 30s and 40s, but other than that, I don't see in the history of football that there has ever been a regime like this that has been implementing genocide, apartheid, occupation, ethnic cleansing at the same time as participating in international football.
In response to the PFA's calls, FIFA said its disciplinary committee would investigate the alleged offenses. But that was now a year ago, and there have been no updates ever since. FIFA did not respond to a request for comment on the matter. Last week, FIFA President Gianni Infantino said in a statement that FIFA cannot solve geopolitical problems, but it can and must promote football around the world by harnessing its humanitarian values. Still, Volarev thinks the momentum is shifting.
You see the pressure building up on every level, and I expect that this will continue growing and that it will at some point simply become impossible to defend.
This issue would undoubtedly be raised, even if there was not a major tournament next year. But of course, there is. The World Cup's approaching kickoff date adds pressure. The FIFA marketing machine is fully fired up with the official ball presented last week. Its design symbolizes the three host countries, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Government officials in Mexico and Canada have not yet commented on Israel's participation, but the U.S. administration has. A State Department spokesperson told me, quote, "We will absolutely work to fully stop any effort to attempt to ban Israel's national soccer team from the World Cup." Israel still needs to qualify for next year's World Cup, though. They continue that quest with a game against Norway on Saturday. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Authorities in the African nation of Eswatini said a group of 10 deportees from the U.S. arrived there today. Government officials said the deportees have been sent to one of the country's correctional facilities. More than 40 people deported from the U.S. have been sent to African countries since President Trump took office in January.
Australia and Papua New Guinea have signed a mutual defense agreement. Lawmakers in both countries will need to ratify the deal for it to go into effect. China criticized the security pact, saying that it unfairly targets the Chinese government. Australia has similar agreements with both the United States and New Zealand. For Papua New Guinea, this defense treaty would be a first.
And in Japan, a hardline conservative could become the country's first ever female prime minister. Sanae Takaichi was just picked to be the leader of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. She's a former minister of economic security who holds some staunchly conservative views that might make it difficult for her embattled party to stay in power.
And those are a few things you might have missed. We live in a world so packed with sounds that they often fade into the background. From traffic to televisions to TikTok videos, it's cacophony almost everywhere. In Norway, these often unnoticed sounds take center stage at a contemporary art exhibit south of Oslo. It's called the Momentum Biennale. Lars Bevanger from our partners at Deutsche Welle DW went to check it out and lend an ear.
Nicholas Hughes is the curator of mediation at Gallery F15, housed in an old farmstead surrounded by beautiful woodland near the city of Moss, around an hour south of Oslo.
So there's this real balance of contemporary art and nature. And this momentum, this specific momentum, is based on sound art. So all the artists work with sound as a medium in some respect.
Many of the installations here highlight topical but perhaps somewhat forgotten issues, like this one called Viz Unnecessary Force No. 4 by Norwegian-based Mexican artist Luz Maria Sanchez.
What you see on site at Momentum is an oval of loudspeakers that are arranged at ear level. And there's an invitation to the visitors to activate the loudspeakers.
Her work addresses the forced disappearances of people in Mexico at the hands of drug cartels. Sanchez's recordings are from one of the expeditions of Las Rastreadoras de El Fuerte, or the Trackers of El Fuerte. These are groups of women searching for buried victims, often relatives. Sanchez is documenting their strong community bonds through sounds of them talking and laughing together, as well as sounds of them digging up clandestine graves in the hope of identifying the disappeared.
This very touching way of being together, I think that helps also the general public when they know about these stories. That it's not just the harsh of the search, but it's also the need of being together and be alive, to keep on searching. And I think that's what I tried to share in this artwork.
This is a very visual story too. You've got some pictures on the walls, but why have you chosen sound as your principal medium?
I feel like when you are exposed to visual, elements. You can close your eyes, but sound is always there. Even if we decide not to listen, we're hearing. We cannot close our ears. So when you're there and you're listening and the sound is surrounding you and you can hear their voices and how they move from one place to the other, you are in the middle of that. So you are really in the middle of this action that I tried to translate into the exhibition space.
It's out here in the woods surrounding the actual gallery where the interaction of nature and sound really comes to life. This installation by Norwegian-British artist Natasha Barrett picks up the natural sounds of trees, wind, and humans and amplify it through speakers hidden in the trees around me, playing it back on a slightly distorted loop. It's hard to tell where nature starts and where the sound creation begins. Walking around the entire exhibition space, a forest, fields and gardens near the fjord, takes about an hour, or it could take days, depending on how long you want to linger. I'm approaching another hidden work of art, and I think I'll let the artist tell you about it.
I am Jakob Kierkegaard. I'm a Danish sound artist, composer. The installation is called The Grey Zone Neverwhere, and it consists of sound recordings that I made in Chernobyl in 2005 of a swimming pool, of course abandoned like the rest of Chernobyl. But this swimming pool had a particular sound because water was dripping from the ceiling. The inspiration for creating this piece comes from way back when I was traveling in the nature in Chernobyl. That is a place where I cannot see that there is something wrong, the radioactivity that is everywhere, but I know it's there.
What this exhibition truly reminds you to do is to stop and really listen. That is something we have lost in today's busy world, believes artist Jakob Kierkegaard.
The interesting thing about listening is that it takes time. You can look at a picture and you can just look for 1 second, but you want to listen to a piece of music or sound art, it takes time and you also need to be quiet.
That was Lars Bevanger reporting for our partners with the DW podcast Inside Europe. You can find Inside Europe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you happen to be in Norway, the Momentum Biennale runs for one more week. It features more than 40 artists from 5 different continents.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. India has the largest population of wild Asian elephants anywhere. And for the first time in several centuries, the animals are venturing into the state of Andhra Pradesh.
That's because they're being pushed out of their native habitats. They're also getting pulled into places where they're coming into contact with humans more frequently. It's a problem both for people and the elephants themselves. In the first of a 2-part series on elephants in new territory, reporter Namrata Kolachlam traced the path of one herd from a national forest to the farming villages of Chittoor.
It's past midnight, and I'm driving with my guide through the forests of Banargatta National Park, 2 hours outside of the city of Bengaluru. Our jeep's high beams cut through the pitch-black darkness, and all along the winding roads, our light catches elephant crossing signs. Then we hear one. And another. Later that night, I spot my first elephant in the wild, a mother and her calf nibbling on tree branches. They're big, that goes without saying, but even bigger than I'd imagined. And they're fast.
They're going.
They leave as soon as our lights appear. More than 600 elephants live in this area, and each animal eats around 500 pounds of food each day. To find that much food, these elephants are constantly on the move, and their journeys get harder each year. Their traditional routes through lush forests have transformed into a patchwork of protected reserves, privately owned forests, croplands, and villages. They have to cross highways, railways, and even state borders. For humans, though, their arrival is not just difficult. It's dangerous. Sometimes, a person trying to scare an elephant off their land will cause it to charge. Sometimes, a mother elephant will become aggressive to protect her calf. In just over a decade, more than 25 people were killed by elephants in Chitthur District alone. Near a temple, I meet a Forest Department official named Govindappa. He can easily observe elephants from this hilltop that overlooks borders between Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, and Andhra Pradesh. Yes, we see them near the villages, he says. Officials from all three states sometimes burst firecrackers to scare the elephants into leaving their state and moving into another. It's loud and smoky, and the elephants can't relax. From here, they go there. From there, they go here, Govindappa adds. One of the places they end up is a district called Chitthur in the state of Andhra Pradesh, where I meet an elderly man named Swaminathan. He describes a recent elephant encounter. It was a huge elephant. It was running. Its legs were this wide. If it had stepped on someone. He tries to capture the terrible noises it made, waving his walking stick in the air. When the elephants first arrived, in smaller numbers, people were excited. Elephants are revered here because of their connection to the Hindu god Ganesha. But in the last decade, the elephant population here has jumped from about 30 to more than 100. Nirja, a woman who farms alongside her husband, says the elephants can be aggressive. If it sees someone, she says, it sets off running towards that person. Another farmer, Prasha Mantri, stands along a field of rice paddy, recounting a recent time he saw a trio of elephants in his fields. His portable radio plays as he talks. I get scared. I don't go near them, he says. Elephant experts are trying to understand the exact reasons that elephants have moved to this state. Are elephants being forced out of their traditional habitats? Or is something drawing them to their new habitats? One thing most people agree on is that elephants first arrived in the state due to climate events back in the 1980s.
1982 has been described as the most intense El Nino year of the last century. Then this major drought occurred in 1982.
That's Raman Sukumar, a leading expert on Asian elephants. He says,
I call this the last straw that broke the camel's back. And then elephants decide, okay, I need to go and look for fresh pastures.
Several elephants left the hills of Banargeta and the Kaveri North Wildlife Sanctuary and headed northeast. More than 100 miles later, they stopped in the Chitthur district. But the factors pulling them here could be even more significant. Acres of paddy fields, cornfields, banana trees, mango trees, and more. All crops elephants love. Humans love them too. They're crops that farmers are turning to more and more.
Over the past 2 to 3 decades, the pattern is almost, you can say, drastically changed in various localities.
That's Kameswara Rao Kothamraju, an environmental scientist in Andhra Pradesh. He says that climate change across the Bay of Bengal has made rainfall patterns unpredictable. So whereas farmers here used to grow traditional crops like millet in modest quantities, now they're irrigating more and growing lots of tasty fruits and veggies because of it. Later, I sit with Avinash Krishnan, who runs the conservation group Arosha India. He says that farmers in Chitthur district are now able to plant these crops year-round, and elephants have become used to this nutrient-dense diet.
For me, if crops are the foremost diet of elephants, then climate change has a direct bearing.
That puts farmers in a tough position.
Conflict here becomes what was initially seasonal to something that's more annual.
The crops are their livelihood. But as long as they keep cultivating this stuff, the elephants are likely to keep coming. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam, Chitthur, India.
The problem of too many elephants is not unique to Chitthur. Tomorrow, a different herd of elephants in a different community also causing similar havoc.
Farming, mining, and climate change all come together in that story. And the results for elephants and for people, not great. That is tomorrow on the show.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. That's also where you can subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you again right here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Jan Elizabeth, Jane Johnson, Kira and Peter McGrath, Leslie Meadowcroft, Maggie Walker, Ravi Mohan, and Rich Gorlick. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.